What I'm going to talk about, by request. I wonder who requested it. Anybody? Is the meaning of the Tibetan idea of raising the dead, raising the dead. Do you know the story of Tibetan techniques of raising the dead, where you get a corpse, preferably fresh, and you put the corpse on the ground, and you lie on top of the corpse, leg for leg, arm for arm, and you make yourself congruent with the corpse. That's very important. Congruent. That means you lie exactly like one triangle on another, fitting perfectly. And then you bite the tongue of the corpse. This is very important. You must bite the tongue of the corpse. I don't know whether the corpse has put its tongue out for a special purpose, or whether you have to hook it first with a finger, in which case the arm you use to hook it with is at that moment not congruent with the corpse. So let's assume that the corpse died with the tongue out, in which case we'll say it must have been a male corpse. The idea is that if you bite the tongue of the corpse and lie congruent with it and concentrate very hard, a vibration will start in the body of the corpse. The vibration will then increase and increase. If you don't get too scared, the vibration will reanimate the body, and then the corpse, at a certain critical point, will jump up and dance about. And this is recommended as a method of raising corpses. Now, like all such priestly mysteries, there are four levels of interpretation. You know, the lowest level is the literal level, where you think it means a corpse, like a corpse you find any day of the week lying about. And the second way, the allegorical way, is that you think it doesn't really mean a physical corpse of a dead man, but a corpse like something not as lively as it ought to be. And you tell yourself a little story about this corpse, which is not a truly dead body of a once living being. The third level, the homiletic, means that you get a large crowd of people, about 50,000 strong, say a football crowd, and you then lecture them about the art of raising their own level of appreciation of life. And the fourth level is the mystical level. And we're going to talk about the fourth level. In the fourth level, the corpse is oneself. There is a joke about Shiva Shava. The S-H-I-V-A is the god of the universe, and if you change the vowel I into A, Shiva becomes Shava, corpse. Now, if you hold the tongue in ordinary speech, it means you keep quiet. Hold your tongue means keep quiet. The fundamental idea is that you have to make your consciousness congruent with your organism. You must make yourself fit yourself. Now, you know that ordinarily you're thinking about one thing, feeling about another, willing about another, and probably doing something physically totally different. So there's no congruence in the average person's average daily life. But this congruence has to be attained. And remember the word mystic. In some way, to shut one's mouth, to keep the secret. Mysteries are secret. It is saying, if you manage to get hold of your own tongue in your own teeth, you know the expression, I could have bitten my tongue for saying something. If you get your tongue in your own teeth, so your tongue cannot say anything, it will try to say something. It will vibrate. If you want to live, if you want to say peace, and if you allow it to, it will remain dead. Now, by dead is meant suffering from inertia. When Jesus talks about the quick and the dead, he means those who are capable of initiative and those who are not, those who are wrapped in inertia. The dead are the inert. The inert means a habitual process which is not examined but conducts itself without any overlooking, without any congruence of consciousness. Now people are continuously finding themselves saying things that they don't mean. They've been acquired in situations over which they have no control, say like quarrels between parents. Children pick up the naughty words during the vow and find them very effective. Now every word that is learned by a child and becomes engraved in the mind of that child, and then an appropriate stimulus comes out on the tongue, that word is a mechanical reaction. It is not an initiated willed action. It is not free. It is not new. It's a repetition of an old pattern. Now, if we allow habitual processes in our organism, a thought, feeling, will, physical activities, if we allow them, and perhaps are not even aware of them, then we have to say they are not acts of initiative. They are not free-willed acts. But the quarrels of the human race, whether it's in Lebanon or South America or Iraq, Iran, anywhere throughout the world where there are quarrels, those quarrels are in general initiated by words. That is, they have the tongue not being bitten, the tongue being reactive to things learned. All the quarrels that nations and individuals have are nothing but mechanics. If we recognize this, we can understand this story about raising the dead. To make oneself congruent with one's own organism means that consciousness must be aware of its thinking process, must be aware of its feeling, its like-dislike, must be aware of its volitional intention and aware of its physical reactivity. If it is aware of all of these and retains the initiative, then it is congruent. If it forgets any one of them or two, then the forgotten portion is not congruent and there is no control over that part. Let's think about this very carefully, because it is the key to human relations. I understand that next week there's going to be a program about the dissolution of marriages in the country, where a very, very high percentage of marriages dissolve. They dissolve because the tongue will persist in reciting things learned long ago. Every time the organism is touched, every time the image is insulted, out comes the word, the tongue rattles away, utters things learned long ago, and wounds the other person, and the other person retaliates. So if you can imagine two tongues having an argument, and they're supplied with a tank of ancestral nonsense, and as long as the tank is not empty, they will talk. And we have solid evidence that protoplasm, the substance of our body, is a recording instrument of tremendous sensitivity. It records thought, records feelings, impulses of the will, the memories of physical activities, and everything it can remember, it can actually replay at any level. of thought, feeling, will, physicality. We have to say then that the tendency of the tongue, supplied with energy, is simply to repeat ancestral, habitual, argumentative patterns. And if it is not stopped, if the initiative doesn't seize the tongue, then it will destroy most relationships. If you can control the tongue, it says in the Bible, you can control the whole body. Now why does it say this? Because the tongue is the thin end of the wedge. You know that wedge is an expression symbolizing the genital organ. And the tongue is the other end of that body. The tongue has been evolved over millions of years to articulate, to verbalize the intentions and misintentions of the will. At one end of the body you have a primordial urge, and the other end you have a tongue. And the tongue has actually been grown in order to articulate and command the situation. So the tongue really is really a very refined gullible appetite. You know that the mucous lining of your body, the food tube, is continuous from your mouth, from your lips, right through the body along that food tube, right to the termination, the anal termination. There's one continuous mucous lining. That means that that body is a unity. It is a unity of appetite. And at one end, the appetite is all power, all push. And at the other end, it's all articulation, all explanation, all excuses. If we want to recognize that, we can see the meaning of that little story, how to raise the dead. For millions of years, there has been an evolution towards articulating appetival needs, positive and negative. To posit what you want, to use words that will get it, and to negate what you don't want and use words that will destroy opposition. So your vocabulary is in two parts: helpful, constructive, and unhelpful, destructive parts. Now the appetite is very, very fast. Unlike the nervous propagation of an impulse along the nerve, which is relatively slow, the biomagnetic field of your body is many thousand times faster than the nerve impulse. And that means that our appetite can actually beat to the punch any time, any argument. You might have noticed that in argument, if your image is hurt, if something unkind is said to you, a word appears on your tongue without any effort. If the mood is good, the word will be good. If the mood is bad, the word will be bad. And you don't need to look for it. It's there on the tongue. The reason for that is that our body approaches us and stretches backwards through the ancestry, and the ancestors are equipped through experience over millions of years for all kinds of situations. Now, if we understand that we are dead when we react mechanically to a stimulus, and that we do not live until we can control our reactions to the stimulus, then we will understand the story. We have to get hold of our tongue and stop our tongue reacting mechanically to the recorded experiences of our ancestors. Now, to do this, obviously, we have to become conscious of this fact that we are the authors of our own activity. It is no use for us to say, I didn't do it, he said this, she said that, I merely reacted. We are responsible not only for our actions, but for our reactions to other people's actions. So there's total responsibility in the story of how to raise the dead. We are all dead in so far as our thoughts, feelings, wills and actions are not the immediate product of initiative in the here and now. Anything except the now, here situation is dictated to by the past and future aspirations. Projections are from the past, from pleasures and pains stored up, trying to project themselves into a future. So we have to say, we must then recognize in ourselves that we are the authors of our own being, the authors of our thought and feeling and will, and that we are never at any time justified in blaming another person's stimulus for causing our reaction. Our reaction is ours. And ours means it goes back through our total ancestry. So the stimulus hits not only on our immediate consciousness of ourselves as an egoic being, that stimulus hits back and by resonance raises ancestors from millions of years ago, thousands of years ago, hundreds, grandfathers, parents, all these come forward on the appropriate stimulus. So to break the mechanistic responses of the organism, we have to get hold of the word, which is symbolized in the tongue. We must become able to get hold of the tongue and control it. And when we control it, it's going to fight. It's going to vibrate. It's going to try to say that thing. How many of you have already noticed that if you're in a profound disagreement, and if you try to not say something you know is going to produce a further reaction, you feel energy pile up inside you? Have you noticed that? Energy piles up inside you and fights your attempt to inhibit this action. There's a war. We'll see what is the origin of this war in a moment. War always implies that at least two forces in opposition. The first force is the force of infinite consciousness itself, that is infinitely extended. That consciousness is absolute. We will represent that consciousness with the letter A. So if I draw a letter A, should I draw a letter A on here so we can see it? Well, that is the letter A. That is the Alpha of the Greeks, the Aleph of the Hebrew. That A is not just an arbitrary scribble, which happened to symbolize the sound R as breathing. It was deliberately designed by priests, kings, to represent something very important. From an originating point, there came down a split into two parts, and this side of it is intellection and that side is volition, and the crossbar is the link factor implicit in the originating point. So when we see a letter A, we have to remember this peculiar fact. In English we say A, in practically every other language we don't, we say R. The English are very good at being individuated, different, and awkward. A for awkward. In the word awkward, in English, you don't say awkward, you say awkward. Whereas they would say A otherwise. But English spelling is very ambiguous, which is a great nuisance to foreigners. If you learn Italian, you have no problem. Every vowel is quite simply itself and doesn't change. But if you learn English, everything changes all the time. Because English is super diplomat and will change anything to anything as the occasion requires. Now the A in that form, in our cake document, represented like that. All you do is just become it, a couple of talons like that, and it's a primitive drawing of a vulture. You'll find that in the Egyptian hieroglyph. In some it represents an eagle. In both cases it represents a high flying intellect. Now if there is a high flyer, as Lao Tse would say, to define a high flyer is to define a low flyer. So we find the same letter turned upside down like this, and it is now said to mean an ox. And the meaning of the Hebrew letter equivalent to this, namely Aleph, means an ox. If we like to add a couple of ears there, and eyes, that is our ox. Now, the eagle or vulture and the ox are both symbolized by the same thing, the same sign, the same symbol, but in the one case the apex is at the top, and the other the apex is the bottom. Now that is not accidental. Did any of you see the recent pronouncement from Israel about the Office of Symbolic Control? What was the paper, David, where the article appeared? Have you? One strange coincidence. I didn't ask you to do that, did I? Would you mind reading it out? In blood. And there you see an official body controlling the use of symbols. Did you know there was such a body? That governments in every country have a language control and symbol control body. Why? Because the symbols with which you think control your activity. An idea expressed in a word generates a feeling, an emotion, and the emotion passes into activity. So if you can control the symbol, you can control the behavior. Now, when you have your apex at the top, it is signifying that your consciousness is spiritual. It is not grounded in the earth. When your apex is below, as in the ox, their breath goes down to the ground even as the beast, it means your consciousness is materialized. Your consciousness breeds a materialistic philosophy. Now, people that believe in materialism, say like naive Marxists, believe that matter determines the evolution of the universe. Actually, Karl Marx himself did not believe that and didn't say it. Nevertheless, there are naive Marxists who think he did say it. Those who are gross materialists are conditioned by the information coming from external material objects through the five senses and patterning together in the lower mind, result in ideas based on the external material world. So the mental process is totally conditioned by materialism. Now, to be conditioned in that way is to be a slave to the external stimulus. On the other hand, if you put your apex at the top, you say, no, the earth itself is a condensation of power which was originally distributed equitably before the universe existed, before creation. There was infinite power, and you're not going to place yourself in material data which condition you. You're going to place yourself in spirit. Now, spirit means free initiative. So if your apex is at the top, as in the vulture or adler or eagle, then you are saying, I'm seated in initiative. I'm not waiting for the external stimulus to condition me. I initiate my actions from within. Now, there is another way the A is written, and we'll draw that also. It is like this. Now, on its side, like that, all we have to do to find its origin is this. It is an I. Now, in our language, I begins with an E. But luckily, we have another language, German, where it begins with an A, which is a primitive symbol of Indo-Germanic origin, Aryan. And it says that the absolute is the observer who is not finite. So the same symbol can mean a transcendent, initiative, ruling being, like an eagle, or a high-flying bird seeing all things, like a vulture, or it can mean an enslaved, grossly materialized creature like an ox, turning round in a circle to grind the corn, or it can mean an observer who sees both the others. Now, if we say the eagle is a predator, and the ox and all beasts that go to the ground are prey, then we have predators and prey, and the third kind, the observers, who are neither predators nor prey. The observer is neither a predator nor prey. He has no desire to be a predator and go around jumping on defenseless deer in the form of a lioness. He has no desire to be the deer jumped upon. He's too intelligent and too awake. And in alchemical doctrines, he would be simply called the artist, A for artist. Now, the word art and the Hebrew Torah and Rota are all the same word. The law is observation. The law is consciousness is the catalyst. Consciousness creates being. The intentions of consciousness precipitate ideas, magnetize them with feelings, and create activities. Now let us look at this A, the one we originally drew, and put three aspects inside that A. We'll say the letter R, a free breathing. That free breathing means spirit. It means infinite spirit. It means spirit in no way limited. But spirit is initiative. And initiative is conscious power. Initiative is power that knows that it is power. And when it converges consciousness, it converges power. So that to converge consciousness and to converge power are really two expressions for the same fact. To converge consciousness is to converge power. This is why in yoga the most important thing to acquire is ekacitta, one-pointed mind. When the mind comes to a point, it precipitates. Now all power is sentient. All energy is sentient. It feels itself and knows itself to be what it is, and it knows exactly what it is doing with itself as power. It is self-precipitating. Now we have to represent the power of the Absolute streaming forth from the are, or primordial power. So we write a letter to you, my bad. We've now written A-U, A-U. If I were to add a G and an E, I've written the word Auge, which is German for I. We'll look at that again in a moment, because the A-U means absolute power driving, and the G-E is the same G-E in geography. It means earth. It means consolidated life. So Auge in the German actually means the absolute power which by self-consolidation brings itself into existential living. The driving power that comes out of the primordial absolute are coming down needs resistance, and it creates its own resistance as we see by this polarizing process. It goes down like this, and it continuously distinguishes between intellection and volition. I'm going to put a line there and leave the dots there. Where the dots are, that means separative ideas, and where the continuity is, it means the non-discontinuity of the will. The will is always one, but the ideas can be broken into many. The will is always one. The initiative is always one. But ideas can be split by analysis. Now, when it polarizes, it writes for itself a letter T. And the letter T symbolizes in the mouth, by the way you execute it, there is the arch of your mouth, and there is the tongue, touching it, teh. It means an intersection. It comes down like this, and carrying on with this polarization, it creates for itself a resistance because it is inside its own infinity, so that it can oppose itself. And the opposition which it presents itself with is what we call matter. It impinges like this, and that horizontal line represents the linear extension of the material world. And continue these two lines here, and that's the letter H. Now, in masonry of the archaic world, you had a little sign like that, and it was called a triple tau. It's TH, Templum Hierosum. Let us say the Temple of Jerusalem, the Temple of the City of Peace. The City of Peace is the balanced human being. Here, the opposition force of the will and the intellect are made into a simple glyph, the letter H. But it's two T's pressing against each other, because the material world is nothing but self-opposing power. And at the intersection point of the two there is the instant, here now moment. The instant. The instant is the point at which the absolute power driving forth creates for itself a resistance and hits that resistance, and at the point of impact creates a now. Now if we look at that, we've written A-U-T-H. And we have to contain this in order to express that this absolute divinity here is incarnate in every human being. So we draw ourselves a nice big O like this. We've now written A-U-T-H. O. The O is the container. Now all we need is the letter Av. Letter R, the Ruach, the Resh, means to vibrate. It means that forces are in opposition, striking against each other. To represent it, we're just going to go over that O, and we'll vibrate it like this. And all this dithering around here is the letter R. The dithering is the letter R. We've now got the word author written in its original form. This is how the word author sounds and is a vibratory structure within the field of every individual being. Now, every individual being is an author, that is to say, a power of the Absolute driving onto a point in which it crucifies itself in an opposition field of idea and will within an encapsulation zone. Now, outside that zone we call it spirit, which means absolutely free initiative, and inside it we call it soul. The soul is simply spirit encapsulated. Now we have to think very carefully about this. It means we are each of us individually absolutely self-responsible. And funnily enough, this is the one thing that human beings generally don't like. We say absolutely responsible because in the place where we are as individuals, it is the absolute individuating. It is not something else. It is the absolute individuating. There's my friend Arthur Berwitz. Next to him is his wife. They are both absolutely self-precipitating. One as a man, one as a woman. And the will to be exactly what they are is there expressing itself physically, in a certain manner, with certain coloration, certain bone forms, and so on. That visible expression, the concrete physicality of a being, shows something of their origin. We call the signature of being. Signature is S-I-G, that means spirit into earth, and nature means the law of the rotating of sensuality. Every person is marked, stamped, engraved with the totality of the intentions of the long protoplasmic body, which has evolved up to that very point where now sits in a chair an individual. And every individual sitting on a chair is sitting there with absolute authority to do so. The absolute is not separate from the individual. The individual is a modality of the absolute. Sitting on the chairs here, we are individual, absolute beings sitting on chairs because through a long process of searching, we have come to be determined to discover what it is that makes us tick. And we come up with the conclusion we make us tick. Each individual must say, I make me tick. I haven't noticed it before, but I have done it. Now you have a beautiful saying. Can you remember that diagram a moment? Possibly. Can you still see it in your mind? Keep that in your mind and say to yourself, this is a true diagram of myself. I am a soul, means I am a spirit, encapsulated. That I am a spirit means I am initiative power. I am intelligence, I am power, and I initiate my presence here and now. And you know that everything in the universe vibrates. There is no thing whatever that can be examined by science that is not vibratory. A vibration is contraction, expansion, contraction, expansion. Now, on the moment of the contraction, there is contraction, Because the three, that is the metai, the are, in the act of moving towards the center, has contradicted its absoluteness. The are and the u are in self-contradiction. The are means to move, to drive. So the absolute is already infinitely extended. Now, to the infinitely extended field of sentient power, what can movement mean? It's already everywhere. It means there is an intention generated when you move. Now imagine an intention is an inner tension within the field of power. Imagine the infinitely extended field of power, call it the supreme no-thing. It is not a thing, it's an infinitely extended field of power. And then, because it's infinitely extended, it can't go anywhere. But what it can do, because it is sentient, it can focus anywhere within itself. And the focus is simply an intention to look inward. And in the act of the intention, there appears a tension. Now we represent that tension with a dot. The letter Yud in the Hebrew means a jot or dot and signifies a primordial point precipitated by infinite absolute intelligence. But the absolute intelligence is infinite and the point is finite. So at the very moment of the absolute positing that point, which is actually the primordial word I-E, A-I, I, R-E. The dot on the I is the original letter. The precipitated point is a focus within infinity. The infinity is not focused, but it focuses within itself a point. But that makes opposition. That makes contradiction. Because the infinitely extended is not the finitely positive. But the finitely positive is not the infinite extension as to its infinity. And yet that point is a modality of the intention of that infinite field. So there is a primordial contradiction. Right at the beginning of creation, because the infinite extended sentient power is positing a point, and the point posited is finite, and is a resistance point to the infinite. Now when you push that point, it develops a letter U. You can see if I push my hand into space, I part the air, and the air goes into the shape like a letter U. If I blow a column of air out of my mouth, I blow a hole in the atmosphere. So if I were to blow the shape of the atmosphere, I would draw a letter U. So when I push the letter I, the primordial point, it generates a U. So R-E-U. And so the absolute point push. Immediately we see the absolute is the originator of the drive or push, which is the letter U. But the moment that U is formed, can you see there, if I push through space, I'm meeting here the resistance of the air. If I take this pen and push it through space like a rocket, it's hitting the air. The plane of the air is like that, and the moving of the pen is like that, and where they impact, they make a letter T. Now the tea is nothing but the product of the absolute intention to move. But the letter T means that the energy of the moving force in hitting the opposition is pinned in the opposition. And the letter T means to be crucified. If you get your Hebrew lexicon out and look at the alphabet, the last letter, Tau, Sephardic Tau in Ashkenazi, that letter means a cross. It means crucifixion. It means if you push, you will generate opposition. If you push, you generate opposition. Now this is the key to successful relationships. Don't push. But everybody wants to push. Now the reason there is a push is because the absolute, in its infinity, before creation, is looking at what? Nothing. It could look at everything, but in fact, it is looking at nothing. That is, at no thing. Imagine the absolute as an observing eye, not the ball of the eye, but the consciousness of the eye. And imagine there is no eyeball. Imagine there is no mirror. What does that absolute see? What is it like to be consciousness infinitely extended and to be looking where nothing is? What is it like? What does it feel like? Have you ever opened your eyes in the middle of the night when it's black, pitch black, no lights on, no lights outside, black sky? You might have heard something like that. Wait. And you see nothing. How do you feel? At risk. Maybe there's a man under the bed. Maybe you're a woman and there's a man under the bed. Maybe you're a man and you don't care whether it's a man or a woman under the bed. But certainly your eyes open. Now, in the mystical parlance, it is said that angels and original man had no eyelids. Did you know that angels have no eyelids? Isn't that strange? No eyelids. Adam had no eyelids. I want you to deliberately open your eyes wide. Stare at the darkest piece of carpet or background that you can see. And feel yourself staring at no thing. And then tell yourself, I have no eyelids. How do you feel? How would you like to stay that way eternally? Are you happy? You would be. I think you would. Must try it sometime. No, there was no being there. You mustn't use the letter B until you encapsulate. So you can't use any idea whatever derived from being. It's just pure consciousness looking where nothing is, with no eyelids. Now we have come into existence, and we are modalities of that absolute. And therefore our existence proves that that absolute invented eyelids. If you said it got fed up with staring, that wouldn't be quite correct. Because the feeding image is derived from the finite world. But if you said it was eternally full of itself, that would be nearer. But what it was, you have to cross the word self off, because it has associations of a finite being. Just, you can't literally imagine it, because you can't make an image. You get the feeling that you are infinitely extended awareness, and you're looking into no thing eternally. There's a very strong feeling that you could do with the rest. intention. Yes, but the intention is to have a rest. Now that word rest is very interesting, because it actually means the differentiation of essentially crucified being. That's rest. So when that infinitely extended consciousness focuses, it precipitates a rest point. And rest means est. It is. S-E-S-T. The R means to discriminate. The E means life. The S means receptivity, issuance, T, crucifixion. Those eyes that are wide open, seeing nothing, they want to do that, to focus. And at the moment of that arises intention. And the intention is in an object. The intention, the primordial will to close. That's the point of view. It is also the point where it is possible to fall into forgetfulness that really you are infinite. Because at that very moment you can actually think, my God, I have found something to rest myself. And then go into it like Indra into the pig. And start enjoying the formative process. That letter I, the dot, signifies form. As the power intends inwards, it makes form. And the form catches your imagination. And if you're not careful, you will fall into identification with the form you have precipitated. And if you do that, you have the horrible fact that you, the Absolute, have trapped you in a form of precipitate of yours. And unless you can remember your absoluteness again, there is no salvation. All religions aim at, with all their techniques, whether prayers or meditation, they all aim to restate the awareness of the infinite in the finite, to reposit infinity in yourself as an awareness in you, that you have precipitated you. And no one else can be blamed. You, each one of you, have precipitated yourself. Just like I precipitate myself into my awful condition. We have absolute intention, absolute motivation for everything we do, and we do it. Interest means that you are crucified in the being, and that you have gone in to an earth in terra, made by you in order to rest. You know, the greatest cause of that program thing next week, really, about marriages, will be that most husbands like to rest at home, and therefore they like the wife to be there. They like Delia Smith to have done the cooking. They go out into the world and they do great deeds and they get tired. They want a nice, charming housewife, faithful, pure, dedicated to making sandwiches. Then when you go home, you can rest. And your interest in someone is the interest that you posit in them insofar as you think you can stabilize them and make them a reference point that will be there when you want it. And you can nail it down with words or with demonstrations or with rituals or ceremonies of any kind. If you can nail it down and make it stay there, you can rest. And you will remain interested as long as you think they're at home. If you happen to go on a longboat on a canal for a quiet weekend when you're supposed to be in Valparaiso, unfortunately, see another longboat with your wife with another man on another longboat. It shocks you. You think, where are my sandwiches? Our interest is always for the same reason. Would you think it was as simple as that? Interest means that you make an earth for yourself to rest upon. In the Egyptian myth of the origin of the world, out of the primordial ocean comes a little hillock. And the bird rests on that hillock. That bird means spirit. Something like a phoenix. If that little hillock didn't come in, drawn like a triangle sticking out of the water, because it's three forms, it's form, power, function. It sticks out, and he says, this is the first land that ever appeared in the whole of creation. He's finding the same myth about this mountain or hillock appears in quite separate situations, and in each situation the people say, this is the first one that ever appeared. And on it rests a bird. This bird is the spirit. And the spirit is the infinite observer needing a rest. And the symbol of spirit is fire. And the fire precipitates water. Like it does, you can burn yourself a bit and make the water blister. The water is the symbol of the chaotic psychic energy, passive, waiting to be heated. And then as the heat, that's the fire, operates in the water, it turbulates and it creates for itself a little zone or island, and then sticks that up above the level of the water. And then the fiery spirit can come down and rest on it. But if you rest on one hillock a long time, you get bored. So what you do is lay an egg and set fire to yourself. And then try again. That's the origin of the phoenix. The phoenix simply means the spirit creates conditions to give itself a rest, gets fed up with the rest, sets fire to it, returns to spirit, and then hatches again and another egg. Well, actually, it's discontinuous, isn't it? Because it creates these little references. And all the references are discrete. Like we did the broken line on the egg going down on the sinister side. In the Persian analysis, Ahriman, the devil, means granularity, discontinuity. On the other side is Ahura Mazda, or skylight, which is continuous. You look at the blue sky with no clouds, and you see the continuity of blue. And you look down, and you see a grain of sand, separativity. The granularity is called Ahriman, the devil, and the continuous arc of the blue is the Ahura Mazda, skylight. And we have this opposition. The opposition between an analytical intellect, which breaks things into bits, and a unific will, which does not break itself into bits. And the will is always positing something to be interested in. But it tends to forget that it posited the object to its own interest. Let's apply this in the case of the relation man and woman. Now the primordial polarity arises out of the pre-polarized infinite. The infinite power manifests as S and P, sentience and power. It's a very strange thing, it's very, very subtle. Just think, you feel you exist even when you're not thinking. But if you start thinking about what makes you feel that you exist, and you start looking around and you find you've got a body, and you've got hands and arms, legs, head, if I touch myself with my finger, although my protoplasm is continuous, my contact, my contingency, my with-touchness, my accident straightforward. I mean, if I hit myself there and hurt myself a bit, it's quite tender there, rather interesting. And when it hurts like that, I get an interest. Immediately, where is this point of pain? I must find it exactly and then economically make a little shield. Put it on there. When I found my painful point and then put shields on them, I begin to feel secure. But I felt with my sentience before I did that I could do it. We are fields of sentient power. But the sentience, our feeling ability, isn't the same as the power. Because we can hold the power in abeyance. We can hold the power so that it's not operative. And then we call it potential. Potential means held power. Potential. Power held. This power doesn't need to go into operation. This is an extraordinary difficulty in theories of polarization. Sentience is that whereby we know that we know, and power is that whereby we initiate the changes in what we know. And yet we don't have to initiate changes. We can hold the power, and then it's potential. It's not operative. When we are simply sentient, without precipitating a form as an object, we have held our power of operation still. And the sentience and the power are not separated from each other in the sense of dissociating. You're aware that you are sentient, that you feel yourself. You're aware that you can make a gesture, that you can point, you can punch. You can do these things. And yet you don't have to. So apparently there's this weird kind of possibility of a dissociation between sentience and power. Now, the possibility of the dissociation of sentience and power, when actualized, is the cause of all that we call insanity. Because we feel an infinite potential, and yet our actualities may fall very far short of what we feel to be our infinite potential. We don't actualize all we can do, usually because of fear. Now that Greek word, sebaste, one must terrify the people. If every person knew that he was an absolute self-precipitating, initiating being whose sentient power were two aspects of one ultimate reality, then nobody could be ordered about by anybody else. Now, if you can't order people about, who's going to do the washing up? It is possible to get in each other's way at a single unit sink, to put elbows into ribs in the attempt to be helpful. But it has become historically a fact of the division of labor, sentience and power. Once this division is made in the field of awareness, it is possible to identify with either one to the exclusion of the other one. And let's examine this very carefully, because we have two exactly opposite analyses of this in the mythology of the East and the West. If we chase the Indo-Germanic line right through from Europe to India, we will find that the power mysteriously is vested as female. But in another exactly opposite analysis, the power is male and the sentience is female. Now, from different points of view, this is perfectly true. We can say either of them is male or female. But let's see how. Supposing we say that power, and the word power is P-O-W-E-R, the power means positive situation. The O, which in English stands for a Hebrew samach, prop, seed. The P is the positive. W-E-R means man. You see that in werewolf, maybe. W-E-R means man, manimal from werewolf, German werewolf. Now, if the man goes out hunting, making war, he practices until he can punch. And then the word power means masculinity. And at home, in the cave, waiting 3 months, 6 months, a year for news of husband, the female is extending her awareness. She represents sentience. She represents Hess. She represents Sophia, wisdom. She is feeling, what has happened to the men folk? What has happened to my husband, to my son? Have they been killed in the war? Have they been killed in the hunt? Are they coming home? She extends her field of awareness. In that sense, the S is feminine and the P is masculine. Now, we can reverse the significance quite simply by saying S represents not just sentience, but precision in sentience. S for science. At the moment we say science, we said masculinity. Why? Because the SCI in science means to cut, to analyze. Now when the men went off to war, they had to learn how to make a bent twig into a straight twig. You probably remember, at least the boys will, making bows and arrows as a child, and any bit of bent twig would do for a bow, and any twig would do for an arrow. And you found that if you shot a bent arrow, it didn't fly straight. Now this made you get out your penknife, or even borrow one from a friend who was rich enough to own one, and take off the little knob that spoiled the straightness of your twig until you finish up approximately with a straight twig, which is an arrow. That would fly better. And then you got some art glued to it, a few feathers of a bird at one end, and they would act as a drag, a resistance to the air, and keep one end of it behind while the other was in front. You had made a scientific thing. You had analyzed. In which case, yes, that meant male, and it meant science. Meanwhile, back at the ranch, the lady making hamburgers out of condemned meat was getting mad at you. Supposing there's no war, and it's not hunting season, and you're sitting outside there, and you got your whittling flint with you, and you're looking at this twig and going like this, and you're not concentrating on the spouse, are you? Do you remember, boys? You're so busy with your twig, and you're determined this twig shall be very straight, and you haven't communicated with her. You haven't told her the principles of the flight of the arrow. You've seen a very fat German book called The Introduction to the Principles of Flights on Arrows, and how you have to put three feathers and twist them in a certain way. And if you get the right twist, it will go like this. It will rotate. And the faster it rotates, the more stable it will be in flight, and the more accurate, and the more you can kill your enemies and the animals. And your wife will be very, very proud of you when you've got it right. But you haven't told her about this, and she doesn't care anyway. In that case, the suppressed energy in her becomes rage, and it posits things like soup on the head. You ever had soup on the head? So you see, the S and the P can be changed around. When you change the application of a term, don't be surprised if somebody else thinks you're being consistent. You said S meant female last week, and this way you say it means male. When you change what the medieval scholars called your universe, of discourse or your frame of reference, provided you say we have changed the frame of reference, it is permissible to change the significance, as it could feminine. When she's feeling while the husband is and she's in the cave, as is masculine, when it means the analytic science of the man straightening his tweed. And P is the precision of the male on the hunt or at war. And yet the same thing is pure naked power of suppressed rage about to smite you. And this polarization of S and P can occur in an individual human being at any time. Now, apply this, and we see that our author has a contradiction between the absoluteness, that's the letter A, the R, just like there is a contradiction between the eagle and the ox. One looks up, the other looks down. And yet it's the same symbol and the same power. It's the same power that goes up and the same power that comes down. Nothing goes up except that which came down. Nothing goes down except that which will go up. It's the same, but the universe of discourse or logical frame of reference changes, and you change it deliberately. Now the opposition between R and U means that the absolute is infinitely extended, cannot go anywhere, but the U or U drive can and does go. And it's going to make a point of interest somewhere. But there isn't one, except the one that it generates with its own push. This means that when young people fall in love, they're not looking at each other at all. They're looking inside themselves as an ideal image of a relational possibility with an entity which doesn't exist, which they're busy designing, and they look out, and it happens that at that moment something goes by a biped, and the internal design flashes out and hits this unfortunate creature outside and is pinned onto it. That's it. Would you believe a man actually told me that when he saw his wife for the first time, he knew he loved her? The very first time. What do you think about that? He believed it, didn't he? Do you remember you believed it? That's because you didn't know enough psychology. If you had known that the image of your ideal is not that creature outside, but it's your determination to make yourself an ideal rest point, and you're going to model that other creature into that shape, if you can. And if it's very, very cunning and has a lot of self-control, then in your presence it will so be modeled. It will actually conform to the definition you've made. Like a girl I knew, and this is a fact, she had one blue eye and one brown eye. She had two boyfriends. And she always walked in profile. She's a very cunning girl. That's what you call adjustment to reality. Another opposition, when the energy from the absolute drives and comes down and impinges on matter, and matter is the resistance generated by spirit to itself, then at the point of intersection there is a contradiction again, because the force is driving to establish itself, but it's driving into resistance created by the absolute. So if we take an example in the world, we might have a small boy playing with a rock and a hammer, and there is a law of action reaction in the world of matter. He has a hammer, he hits the rock, and the hammer bounces and hits him. Now the universal law of action-reaction, not yet known by that boy, hits him. the resistance of matter to an impressed force is there. The individual boy who's unaware of that law thinks he can hit that matter and make it give in. He can't. There is a universal law that there is always reaction to action, that every push will beget a counter push. And this law is established simply by the Absolute publishing itself as a resistance, so that no individuated being, and an individuated being is a modality of the Absolute, no individuated being can impose on the Absolute. That's not bad, is it? Call the Absolute the Father, the Abba. As against the Father, the Son is always in the wrong. That means that the finite, temporalized, individual human being, if he opposes the infinite law and hits with his hammer on the rock will not behave the way the man wants, but the way the Absolute wants. The Absolute is the All Father. In the North religion, God is called the All Father. It's the origin of rocks, the mineral world, plants, animals, men, whatever else there are. He is the ultimate origin of all of them. And he's not going to let go of his own authority. But he will allow you to have a relative authority within your field of operation. But that Absolute will never allow you to take absolute control over the Absolute. But only absolute control over your little bit. And the absolute control over your little bit, when you get it, is called your talent. It is a seed of potential lent to you for application. And doesn't this make us terribly self-responsible? Let's add to this another little thought: energy. There was a nature film on last week, and it showed some chamois jumping down a mountain which was covered in icy patches. And these baby chamois jumped up and down, they fell on their backs, on their heads. They were being jumped. They had not yet got reflexive control of their own energy. They were being jumped by energy. Energy is centered. The energy wanted to jump. Because of the jump, if that energy came from the spring, then say from the sun, and the energy is centered, and when the solar energy gets into a living body, it is so delighted at its first entrance into that body, it wants to use that body and to try what that body can do. And it uses the body, and apparently the body jumps. But really the energy is jumping the body. Until the child grows up and gets hold of its own energy, it is at the mercy of that energy, that sentient power. Now that ties in with the biting the tongue. If you can bite your tongue, you've got hold of your primordial energy of will, and you can avoid being jumped by the energy. And if you can't bite your tongue, you are being jumped by universal energy, which is simply experimenting with your being to see what it can do. And it is not individuated in you, by you, until you assume the authority for it. Jesus puts it in the expression, "My Father works and I work." Now you know that your body is grown by cosmic forces from conception onwards, and that it creates organs, cell division, organization, heart, liver, pancreas, spleen. Everything you've got is being conducted for you by universal sentient power, which is called God. And this process of organizing your being goes on and on. And he's looking forward to a time when you will be so developed you can say, right, generative power of the universe, that's called the Father, you have done a good job You have made the organism usable, and now I, the individual, am going to work on the organism in the same way that you are. And when you can say that your work furthers the development of your organism towards greater efficiency in every way, when it is doing that, you are then doing the work of that power. And you may be advancing in one direction and slowing down in another direction. But if you advance too much in one direction, you might become unbalanced. You might forget the other direction. So you keep oscillating, developing in a certain way, to a certain distance, and coming back and developing another thing that you had forgotten about. Our Father, that is the universal power, brought us into being and is moving us through evolution towards a point where we can say, thank you very much, you've got an organism, and now I am going to use it as an individual, because I know that that's what you want me to do. I'm going to consult with you, that's inwardly in yourself, with your highest point of awareness, which is the divinity in you. Find out what you can really do, and then do it efficiently to the best of your ability, and then you say, I work also. When you do that, you've got control of your tongue. You've got control over the energy in your body. When you've got that control, you will not make harmful, destructive remarks to other people that will destroy their organism or put their evolution back. You'll always work towards higher levels of cooperation. Let's close with a reminder of the author. The author is the absolute power driving itself into time matter to provide itself with the resistance whereby it will educate itself about its possibilities and about the contributions it can make by its own personal effort to the further evolution of universal life. Shall we rest upon that?